Okay, I would like to thank Tracy for inviting me here today to speak. My name is Melissa, and I'm a really, really grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to start off by saying that I absolutely love alcoholics, all of them, all of you, all of them, all the ones out in the world. I love alcoholics. They're the most fun people I've ever been around. There's a reason why we all hang out together and, you know, marry each other and stay in the same places and all that kind of stuff, because alcoholics are fun. I never understood a lot of the negativity around the 12-step program. But that being said, I will say that when I was a kid, because I'm a certain age, there was a commercial on TV about AA. I don't know if anybody ever saw that commercial back in the 80s. And I grew up watching that commercial, and the kid would always say, like, I learned it from watching you. And he would be so mad at his parents, and the wife would be yelling at the husband as he's taking off down the driveway. And I thought, well, that's a weird way to do things. That's not what my house looked like growing up. I dislike the term qualifier, because that, to me, implies that there's somebody else responsible for the fact that I'm standing here at this podium talking to you fine folks. I am my own qualifier, because it is my behavior and it is my thought process and my attitudes that got me into hot water. The fact that somebody else's behavior was adjacent to that really isn't the important part of the situation. So I was always taught to share what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And what it was like is that I grew up in a household with an alcoholic parent and an Al-Anon parent. And neither one of my parents identified themselves in that way while I was growing up. So that was fun. I come from a great big Irish Catholic family. One of my uncles calls it the CIA, which stands for the Catholic Irish Alcoholics, which I always thought was funny, because you can look at my family tree and kind of like line out who belongs in which meeting, whether they agree with that or not. But the people in my family that used alcohol or drugs were always really fun people about that. There was always a big barbecue, a big party. There was all the cousins and the aunts and the uncles, and everybody was happy and fun, and there'd be a lot of singing and a lot of dancing and a lot of storytelling, and there was never really any negativity around the drinking. So I didn't grow up thinking that that was a bad thing. I thought that people that drank too much just got mushy, and they'd grab your face and say, I love you so much. And, you know, that would kind of be the end of it. Somebody would pass out, and, you know, you'd put a blanket on them, and that'd be the end of it. And when I was a little kid, that didn't seem like any big deal. Like, that was just, you know, parties, family parties. Sometimes there would be cousins that would sneak drinks of, you know, somebody's glass that got left on the table or whatever, and the adults would think that was cute and funny when the little kids were stumbling around, and I didn't think that was weird either. Turns out that's not normal. There was a lot about the way things happened in my family growing up that wasn't quote-unquote normal, and I didn't know that because that's what I grew up with. So whatever we're around the most, that's what seems normal to us at any given time. And like I said, my family were fun alcoholics. Their drinking behavior was entertaining, and it wasn't mean, and it wasn't messy, and people didn't get DUIs, and people didn't go to jail, and so it looked really normal. There was a lot of functioning alcoholism going on in my childhood and in my household. I think it's interesting, though, and it's worth pointing out that nobody has ever said a functioning Al-Anon, and I think that's a fun fact, because as least for me and the untreated Al-Anons that I deal with, and when I was one, I was not very functioning. I looked like I was functioning because I covered things up really well, but that's not really a very good way to live your life. So, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So growing up in a household with an alcoholic parent and an Al-Anon parent who did not identify themselves as such created a weird dichotomy between the way that we behaved. So there was the home version of me, and there was the school version of me. And they were different kids. Because at home, I learned how to walk on eggshells and how not to make a mess and to not be loud and to always do what I was told and to not make anybody upset, because maybe my dad was hungover, which meant that everything needed to be quiet. So I learned how to play Barbies silently. I read a lot of books, super big bookworm. Read the dictionary one summer just because. And when you have an untreated Al-Anon as your other parent who's mad at the untreated alcoholic, then there's all this tension, and you got to walk on eggshells around that person too, because you don't know what's going to set them off. Because if you're too nice to the alcoholic parent, then the Al-Anon parent's mad at you, and vice versa. So there was just a lot of careful navigating that had to go on as a kid, which meant then when I was at home, I was very quiet and calm and tried to stay small and not be seen, which as somebody who has a Leo placement in like almost every house, that's really hard for me to do. So when I went to school, I was loud and boisterous and talked way too much. And every single report card I ever had said that I was smart and bright, but I talked too much. Well, of course I did, because school was the only place I could talk. So that was a weird way to grow up. Another thing that was weird about growing up was that even though my parents were the way that they were and the things happened the way that they happened, I absolutely loved both of them. Like, when I say I had a great childhood, even though there was alcoholism going on in my house, I'm not joking. Like, it was a fantastic childhood. I had absolutely everything I needed and most of what I wanted, and my dad took great care of all of us, and my mom took great care of us, and even though there was a lot of unhealthy isms happening, there was still also a lot of love and a lot of structure, and I'm really grateful for that, because I know that's not everybody's story. My dad would wake up most of the time a little bit hungover on a Sunday morning, and so his version of church was to get us all in the car and drive down to the beach and hang out at the beach for the day, go to Hollywood and walk around, you know, Hollywood Boulevard and look at all the people and the tourists and the stars and stuff like that. And so we did this cool, like, vagabond thing every weekend, but then, like, Monday through Friday, everybody did what they were supposed to do, and it was all very regimented, and everything was very Leave It to Beaver, and, you know, you just didn't talk about the weird stuff that happened on Saturday. And the other thing that was interesting about growing up is even though there was a lot of drinking and all of that happening around, there was also a lot of camaraderie because my parents had a big friend group. And so there was always people at our house and there was always something happening that was a lot of fun. And all of those people were really great human beings. So I didn't learn how to deal with not great human beings. And that's an important thing to remember, because when I got older and got married and started dealing with a different type of alcoholic and a different type of untreated Al-Anon, I had no way to know how to deal with the ugliness that people have inside their hearts sometimes, because I didn't grow up with that. I know everybody's experience with an alcoholic parent is different, and not everybody's is like mine, but it was fun. It was fun. And I didn't think of drinking as a bad thing, because, like I said, very functional. Everybody held a job. Everybody did what they needed to do. And so it didn't look like a bad thing. Until I got a little bit older and I started to put two and two together, and I realized that sometimes when my dad would drink that particular color alcohol, he wasn't very nice. But if he drank this one that had the bubbles, that was okay, because he was going to be funny. But if he drank the brown one, that was not going to be good. So I would start to get really anxious when I would see somebody drink dark colored alcohol. Didn't matter who you were. If I saw you drinking tequila or rum or anything like that, I started to get nervous and anxious because I thought everybody behaved the same way when they put that thing in their body. Didn't worry about beer. If you were drinking beer, that was fine. I didn't have any concerns about that because that was the happy one, so that was fine. And I found myself as a little kid starting to notice what other people were drinking. That's really strange. Most kids don't do that, but I did. So that part where they talk about counting another person's drinks, I was doing that when I was 7, which, you know, not really very productive. But I learned a lot of things about that that kind of stayed in the back of my head and didn't get reactivated until I got older and I fell in love with the person that I married and had children with. And that person didn't drink alcohol. And I thought, oh, this is really cool. I'm never going to have to worry about the things that my mom had to worry about. I'm never going to have to deal with that kind of stuff because this guy doesn't do those things. He did other things, and there's a meeting for that. And sometimes he went to those and sometimes he didn't. But I thought, okay, well, if there's no alcohol around, then I won't have to worry about this kind of stuff. The thing about that is I'm still me. I'm still anxious. I'm still nervous. I'm still controlling. I learned all of these things later on. I didn't know that that's what I was doing when I was doing them. I thought I was just being a normal person. It's totally not normal. I went through high school, still doing the same thing, the separate me's, the home me and the school me. Every once in a while, those two me's would collide and that would get a little messy and I would usually get in trouble. But for the most part, I was a good kid, right? I did everything that I was told ever, always, by every person in a position of authority forever. I got the good grades. I participated in the extracurricular activities. I didn't do the things that I wasn't supposed to do. I was a good girl. Because if I was a good girl, nobody was going to get mad at me. And that was my big thing, was I never wanted anybody to be mad at me. I didn't realize until later that that was called people-pleasing. I thought I was just being a good kid. So when I was in high school, I remember thinking at the time, because my dad had gone to a rehab in the 90s, and that was the only time that I know of that my mom ever went to an Al-Anon meeting, because she was told that she needed to go, so she went, because she was a rule follower too. She went once. They told her that maybe there was a possibility that she had an issue that she might want to look at, and she didn't like that, so she never went back. And so I grew up thinking that Al-Anon was the same way. Like, that's not for me. I don't have to worry about that. But when my dad went to rehab, I remember I had just started dating the man that I wound up marrying, my ex-husband, and I was embarrassed to tell him that my dad was in rehab because I thought he was going to think negatively of me and my family because of that. And I didn't want anybody to ever think negatively of my family because I thought my family was perfect, even in spite of fill in the blank. So I didn't tell him. I think I told him that my dad was on vacation, maybe. I might have said something like that, which made no sense because my mom was at home and we were at home, and why would he be on vacation without us? But that might have been what I said. And I remember hearing about Al-Anon at that time, but it didn't relate to anything in my life. I didn't think that I needed to go to a meeting. My dad didn't continue to go to AA meetings after he went to rehab that time. And so the whole 12-step program thing just kind of fell out of our lives. Didn't really have any exposure to that, because all the people that I knew that drank and or used drugs were continuing to still do those things. And, you know, their wives were just bossy, cranky, you know, controlling, bitchy, whatever the adjectives were that they used about them. And that was just normal. Those two things always went together. If you had a man that did these things, you had a woman that did these things. And that's just how it worked. So that was just the way things were. I remember my ex-husband and I got married. Still, I'm thinking that everything's cool because he doesn't drink alcohol. So I'm not going to have any of those problems. We were married for about 3 years, I want to say. We had a kid and a half, and by a half, I mean I was pregnant with the second one when I found out that my ex-husband had a drug problem. And I didn't know anything about drugs. Drugs were not a part of my parents' circle. They weren't really something that I had a lot of experience with, so I was really unfamiliar with what that looked like. And I was terrified. And I was mad, and I was all of the things that they say in the don'ts. In the do's and don'ts, I was all of the don'ts. I was an absolute expert at the don'ts. The doormat one being the best one. Like, I used to joke that I should get a doormat tattooed on my back because I was such a good one. I was super efficient at that. So I'm married, I have a toddler, I'm pregnant with another baby, and I find out that my spouse has a great big huge drug problem and he wants to go to rehab. And I thought, okay, cool, that's good. This is what, you know, you see in the movies and on TV, like people go to rehab and then they're gone for a little while and then they come back and everything's great and it's all fixed and it's better. So yay, let's do that. So he goes, and I'm still me, right? I'm still wondering what he's doing. I'm still paying attention to somebody else's behavior more than I'm paying attention to mine. You know, I called the rehab facility and wanted to know what the program was. I wanted to know what the agenda was every day. I needed the breakdown because, you know, don't you know I need to be in charge because you don't know how to take care of him. I do, because clearly I've done such a great job up until this point. And I actually asked these professionals to run their program by me. What? Like, who on earth did I think I was, you know? Well, I thought I was Melissa, and I knew some things, you know, and I know him better than you do, so I'm going to tell you that's not going to work, and he's not going to do that, and he doesn't like to get up that early, and he doesn't like to eat that thing, and, you know, like, I had a PhD in that guy, and it was completely useless in the real world. So the counselors kind of laughed at me and, you know, did the, like, proverbial pat on the head, like, aren't you cute? You think you're going to tell us how to do all of these things here at this facility that we've been running for a really long time before you ever showed up. But okay. And they made a suggestion that I go to an Al-Anon meeting. And I thought, oh, no, I don't need to do that. I don't need to go to a meeting. I don't have a problem. Why would I need to go to a meeting? But because I'm a good girl and I do what I'm told and I like to follow the rules and I enjoy school, I went to a meeting. The first meeting that I went to was in a tiny little church, and it was five women that were probably my grandmother's age, nobody my age, and they all knew each other. They lived in the same town. They'd known each other for, you know, 150 years, and it wasn't very welcoming. But I thought going there, they were going to tell me what I needed to do to help my husband, to get him better so that he could come home and so that everything could be fine in our family. Because don't you know, as long as he wasn't drinking or using drugs, everything was going to be great. So, you know, as anybody who's been to more than one meeting knows, that's not the case. That's not the way it works. But I didn't know that yet. So I went to that meeting for a couple more times. I think maybe the suggestion was that you go to six meetings before you decide if you belong. Even though those women were my grandmother's age, I still knew that I belonged. I knew that the things that they were sharing and the stuff that they were saying about what their families looked like and what their living rooms felt like and what it felt like when they were alone at night, asleep, and not knowing where their loved one was, I knew that I belonged there because I was feeling those same things. So I Googled, if Google was a thing, it might have just been AOL, I don't know, it was a long time ago, 23 years in September. I looked up where there was some other meetings, and I found another meeting. It was on Monday night, and it was my home group all the way up until COVID killed it. And I went every Monday. I started off that first meeting, and I walked in, and I saw a gal at the meeting who had tattoos that I thought were cool, and she was wearing a t-shirt from a band that I liked. And so I asked her to be my sponsor. Those are bad reasons to ask someone to be your sponsor. We had a lot of things in common. We liked the same music and we did the same stuff, but she didn't really have a lot to transmit, so there wasn't a lot that I was going to be able to get. So I didn't really get any better with her as my sponsor. We went to some cool concerts and we had a lot of fun conversations, but I didn't really get a lot better in the program. So I stuck around and I listened, and I heard people say, well, if you like what that person has, ask them to be your sponsor. Like, pay attention to how they speak about their recovery and how their life is now. And if you want what they've got, then ask them how they did what they did. So that's what I did with my next sponsor. And I had her for quite a long time and went through all kinds of interesting activities in my marriage while she was my sponsor. And I say that because one day I might write a book about the things that I went through in my marriage, because it's kind of like a Lifetime movie. When Ricky said that last night, I was like, oh yeah, I know that. I know that feeling. Yep, Lifetime movie, that's my get down for sure. Because my ex-husband was a very busy man. He had a lot of extra time in his day because he chose to do a substance that gave him more hours than the average person. So he filled those hours up with all kinds of fun activities. And sometimes, because of those activities and the people that he was friends with, my family and I got to go on vacations out of town while some heat blew over. And for a girl that's like the rule follower, being married to the guy that causes us to have to go on vacations to other towns because we can't be in the town that we live in for a few days was kind of weird. But it was also super exciting, and I wasn't always mad about it because we went to some cool places. But the reasons behind why we went to the cool places were not good. You know, it's kind of hard to call your kids out of school and say, oh, you know, my son's not going to be at school today because we have to go on the run for a few days. Teachers don't like to hear that. But I was loyal, and I loved him very much, and I was determined to make things better, whether he liked it or not. And I think he mostly probably didn't like it, because I was all of the things that you hear about of an Al-Anon person being smug and self-righteous and unreasonable. I was all of those things on steroids. Because I felt like I knew what was best for another person. And if he would just take my suggestions, surely everything would be better and we could get on about the business of having the life that we were supposed to have, which was going to look like this. And I never really thought to ask him what his vision was. It was just mine, which isn't really fair. But so we We were married all together for 15 years. We were together for 22. And in that time, I went up and down the roller coaster of recovery myself, because I went to meetings for a long time. And then it was suggested to me by my spouse that I didn't need to go to meetings anymore because he was better, so I didn't have to go to meetings anymore. So I didn't go for like 2 years. Bad idea. I don't recommend it for anybody. I think that if you find yourself in a meeting and you feel like you need to be there, then you should just keep right on being there, like forever, because it's important to your own well-being. Before we got divorced, I remember there was a series of shenanigans that happened. Like I said, we went on these vacations, sometimes for a few days, sometimes for a week or two, where we had to just be out of town for a little while, and then we came back, and then everything was fine, and we'd go back to normal, and I would get back to my business of, like, making handmade Christmas cards for everybody for the holidays, you know, and, like, when I say I made handmade Christmas cards, I mean I made the paper, and then I cut the pictures out, and then I did the calligraphy, and, like, I had all these things to keep me busy, and it all looked very like Joanna Gaines, Susie Homemaker, like June Cleaver on acid, honestly. Even though I didn't do drugs, I'm familiar with the effects of some of them, and I was a mess. Like, I was so crazy, because everything had to be perfect, because that's what I grew up with. If everything looked perfect, then everyone would assume that everything was perfect, and nobody would ask any embarrassing questions, and we wouldn't have to talk about anything uncomfortable or anything that might make somebody look bad, because don't you know you can't ever look bad? So I grew up with that perfection model, and then I went ahead and pulled that into my marriage too. Except for not, because I was like my own way about things. So like maybe it looked really perfect on the outside, but also if I didn't want to do the laundry, I wasn't going to do the laundry. And it would pile up, you know, because I was busy making Christmas cards. I couldn't be bothered with the laundry. I was busy following him around town and monitoring who he hung out with and like figuring out how to work phones and, you know, like cross-reference phone calls and all this kind of stuff. I was really busy doing super important things, and so laundry wasn't on the list. But, you know, being a good Al-Anon person, I still went to meetings, and I started to understand the concept that there was something wrong with me, and it didn't have anything to do with whether or not he fill in the blank. And that was a hard thing for me to realize, because I followed the rules, and I did everything that I was supposed to do, and I was a good girl, and I didn't get in trouble with alcohol, and I didn't get in trouble with drugs, and I didn't get in trouble with boys or any of those things. So how could there be such a huge problem in my life that I can't fix? It was a really hard concept for me to grasp. I had gone to a meeting outside of my home meeting. It was in another area, but I enjoyed the group, and I learned about the concept of acceptance. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever heard that A word, but I didn't like it for a long time. Because acceptance in my mind meant approval. And I couldn't possibly approve of the behavior that was going on in my home. Because at this time, now I'm married to somebody who has a substance abuse problem. And I'm also the daughter of someone who still is active in their disease. So I had it coming from both directions. And there wasn't a lot of room to navigate that, because if one of them wasn't acting up, the other one was, guaranteed. Sometimes they both acted up at the same time, and then that was a real mess, you know. And I'm trying to keep everybody happy. I'm trying to keep everybody comfortable. I'm trying to make sure that nobody thinks bad of either one of those gentlemen that I loved so much, except for me, because I was allowed to say whatever ugly, nasty, mean, rotten, awful thing I wanted to say. And I said it a lot. And looking back on that behavior now, how miserable must that have been for somebody to live with a person who just never had anything nice to say about the way that they acted. That must have really been uncomfortable, and I feel bad about that, but that's what living amends are for. I'm getting ahead of myself. When one of them was acting up and the other one was being okay, I would go and spend time more with my mom and dad, and I would talk bad about my spouse. And then when my dad was acting up and my mom was being crazy, I would talk about my parents to my husband. Main thing was that there was never anything wrong with me until I went to enough meetings and got a sponsor that gently suggested that that might not be correct. So then I got to work the steps, And I started doing the process, and I got to the fourth step and did my first fourth step inventory on myself, not on somebody else, because I was really good at doing everybody else's inventory. I knew what was wrong with everybody in a 5-mile radius within 10 or 15 minutes of meeting them. But I never put that laser focus onto myself. So when I finally did my own fourth step inventory, I don't know how I got up off the ground and left that room, because I felt so awful about myself and the way I had been treating the people that I said that I loved for such a long time. And I felt really justified in treating them that way, because clearly they didn't know what the hell they were doing. They can't even stay sober. How condescending. And it was really ugly to see that I was behaving that way. But fortunately for me, I have a really good sponsor, and she helped me see that those defects of character were actually good things about myself that had just gotten distorted by the disease. It's good to care about people. It's good to have concern for a human being other than yourself. It's good to love people, but it's not good to enable them. And I look at the way that I treated my former husband, and I realize that I almost loved him to death, because I made every excuse in the world. I covered up when he went to rehab. I told his parents that he was off on location because he worked in the movie industry, and so I made excuses. And it was very easy to excuse his behavior because of the job that he had. It was easy to excuse it to myself, and it was easy to excuse it to other people. He kept weird hours, so the fact that he didn't have a normal sleep schedule, probably because of the substances he was using, I made excuses about that. I made excuses to our friends, to our family. I made excuses to our children later on down the road when they got older. And I enabled him tremendously. And I realized that I thought I was doing that out of love, but that is not a good way to love somebody. Like I said, I almost loved him to death, because there was nobody in the world that was going to defend him harder or yell at him harder than me. Enabling is a really ugly behavior, and I see it in other people sometimes, and it just makes me cringe, because I'm like, oh man, I did that. I did that so much. That's really ugly. And also the other thing, and I don't know what term we use for it in Al-Anon other than just to call it what it is, but being passive aggressive, super good at that. Like malicious compliance, I'm pretty sure I invented that term. Like I was going to follow the rules and make you wish that I wasn't. I was going to be super judgy. I was going to be really undercover about it, because you were going to think I was being nice, but I wasn't. And Al-Anon helped me learn how not to do any of that stuff, because Al-Anon meetings taught me that if I was pointing a finger at you, there was three pointing back at me. And the behavior that I was not liking about somebody else was probably something that was somewhere in my soup. You know what I mean? The slogans helped me figure that out. And being honest. It's funny because I know a lot of people that are in recovery, and I have a lot of friends in AA that don't go to an Al-Anon meeting. They never have. They're probably never going to. But that's interesting to me, because alcoholism is a family disease, meaning the whole family is impacted by it, whether you know that right away or not. And I always thought it was interesting that some of my AA friends didn't like the Al-Anon side of the house, and vice versa. I know some Al-Anons that would never go to an open AA meeting. But I think there's so much similarity in the way that we suffer and in the way that we share. I listened to the speakers that were here already today, and listening to the things that they said about their experiences, it feels very similar. My drug of choice happens to be people and relationships. So that's where I get twisted up. I don't have a powder or a liquid addiction. I have a person addiction, because I get so wrapped up in somebody else's behavior that I don't know anything about my own anymore. And I get really mean behind that behavior, and I get really self-absorbed, and I get really self-righteous, and it's nasty. And Al-Anon is the only medicine that fixes that. I don't have active alcoholism in my life right now. I haven't for many years, but I'm still me, and I still need a meeting because of that. I will need Al-Anon forever. I will choose Al-Anon forever, because it allows me to be comfortable in my own skin one day at a time. When I think about how hard it has been to adjust myself and to grow through the steps and through sponsorship, I can't imagine how much harder it is for the people that I have loved that have substance abuse problems to grow past their pain. I'm just always grateful for the way things are right now. The way things were was that there was a time in my life where I had to go and live in another state with my kids, and I had to use a different name because my children's father had gotten into some hot water with some people who were affiliated with a group of individuals that ride motorcycles and wear leather vests and have names on the back of their vests, and he got in some hot water with those folks, and so we had to go and live someplace else and use different names for about 6 months. And nobody knew where we went, and nobody knew what happened, and that was really, really scary. But I still went to an Al-Anon meeting while I was gone. It's an anonymous program anyway, right? So I was totally safe there. That was a fun time in my life. I say that now because it's been enough years that I can make jokes about it. When I look back on the things that I chose to participate in vicariously due to being an unwell, codependent people pleaser, I can't believe I did that stuff. Like, you hear about the definition of insanity in meetings, meaning you do the same thing over and over again and you expect a different result. I did that to death in my marriage. Every time there was a sober period and I thought everything was going to be cool, then it was, okay, let's go on vacation and let's buy a new car and let's renew our vows in Hawaii because everything's going to be great right now. No, not the way it worked. That would always come on the heels of discovering that there had been another affair or that there had been another relapse, sometimes both, usually both. And I would always believe that it was going to be better next time because fill in the blank. And I kept going to meetings. I was always going to meetings, even though all of these other shenanigans were still happening, because I had a condition that I like to call the horrible hope. Because I always hoped that the thing that was being said to me in that moment was going to be true this time. I believed that there was, you know, if I believe strong enough, and if I go to enough meetings, and if I behave the right way, everything's going to work out okay. And this time they're going to stay sober. And this time they're not going to be unfaithful. And this time there's not going to be this consequence or that consequence. And that was just never the case. And it took me a lot of time in program to realize that I didn't have any impact on that. It wasn't up to me to make sure that those promises were going to be kept. It wasn't up to me to make sure that meetings were attended to or that bills were paid or that any of that stuff was done. I was still trying to control things even 10 years into being a member of Al-Anon because it's all that I knew and it's all that I could hold on to besides the horrible hope. There was the control and the horrible hope, and it was like a sandwich and it was gross and nobody wanted to eat it, but I had it every day. And I just didn't know what to do with myself. I was going to meetings all the time. I was sponsoring people. I was being sponsored. I was participating, but I wasn't really getting very much better. I was still in my own head way too much. I was still paying too much attention to somebody else's behavior because I didn't know how to let go and let God. I was afraid if I let go, there wasn't going to be anything to hold on to ever again, and I was just going to be out there floating in the universe with no anchor. And that, I think, was because I didn't trust my higher power. Once I started trusting my higher power, then I had a replacement anchor. It wasn't my spouse anymore, because I had put him in my life in the God spot. And that was no place that he should ever have been. That's too much pressure for any person to be your higher power. Your higher power needs to be your higher power, not a human being. And when I had him as my higher power, everybody stayed unwell. But when I had an actual higher power that I call God that actually took care of me and gave me some guidance, that's when everything started to get better for me. I was still married to my spouse all the way up until 2013. And I remember the day that I decided that I didn't want to be married to that person anymore. It happened to be our anniversary. We were out at dinner. We had gone to a Dodger game that day. We had fantastic seats. It was a great time. We went to dinner afterwards, and I say this because I had to go back and make amends to that waitress later on, the waitress at the restaurant, because she came up and asked us what we wanted to have for our drinks. And before she even finished her sentence, I looked at him because he said, oh, it's our anniversary. I don't know what we're going to have. What would you like to have? And I said, oh, I don't want to have any more anniversaries. I don't want to be married to you anymore. At our anniversary dinner in front of this poor waitress who was just trying to take the drink order. And he started crying and I started crying, but I felt better because I had finally made a decision that was only for myself. Because I knew that things weren't going to change, and I knew that I needed to do something different for me. And I needed to detach with love from that person and that person's circumstances if I was going to stand a chance of being a whole person myself. And that was really hard to do after 22 years of loving someone so much. I loved him more than I loved myself. I loved him more than I loved my children, or my friends, or my family, or anybody else. And I look back on that now and I think, ew. Like, not ew because he was bad, but ew because how could I put somebody in that position? That's so unfair. That's really unfair to any person to put that much responsibility for my happiness on their shoulders. That's an inside job. So I told him I didn't want to be married anymore on our anniversary. And then we went home and I told my children, and meanwhile, I never consulted him on any of this. This was all just a decision that I made on my own. And I told my kids that their dad was going to be going on location and he was going to be leaving, and so that they should say goodbye and give him a hug and a kiss, and I wasn't sure when he was going to come back because I still wasn't super good at telling the truth yet. And so I had him leave the house, and then I decided that I was going to need to start figuring out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And that was scary. I had been a stay-at-home mom for all my marriage. All of my work experience was out of date. I didn't know where I was going to go, what I was going to do. I used to have a really good job before I had kids. I worked at an aerospace company, and I had a security clearance, and I did important things, and I worked with important people, but I hadn't done that in a long time. All I had been was a mom and an enabler and a worrywart and, you know, a crazy person. Some of my crazy looked like one of the times that my spouse had an affair, that woman's husband. So he went to rehab, and I learned about the 13th step while he was in rehab. Because he got a girlfriend while he was there. And I didn't know that there was 13 steps. I thought there was only 12, but apparently there are 13. And some people are really good at that 13th step. Like, I think of all of the steps, that was probably the one that he was best at, and it was probably his favorite. But I didn't know about that then. So flash forward to the end of the rehab stay, and he and that woman decided that they were going to run off into the sober sunset together because they understood each other and everything was going to be great. And her husband called me and wanted to get together and have a conversation. And I was like, cool, I can do that because I have pages and stacks and piles of data. Like, I had, no joke, pie charts that like outlined the meetings that he said he was going to and the meetings that she said that she was going to. And really, they weren't going to a meeting at all. They were going to a hotel because, don't you know, I stalked them. And I had phone records and I had emails and I had all this stuff. And I had, like, it looked like one of those boards with like the red string that you see where like you line everything up. And like, that's what I spent my time doing, y'all. That's what I did. Like, I had kids to raise, but nope, I was tracking their behavior and where they were going and what they were doing. And I was so excited to get together and have dinner with this guy and like bust them, because I wanted them both to be in trouble and I wanted them both to feel terrible about the mean, rotten things that they did to their nice spouses. And I had all of this information. Well, that wasn't the idea that that gentleman had for what the evening's activities were going to be. And I was shocked. What do you mean you don't want my pie charts and my data and my piles of information? Huh? And that's when I started to realize that everybody's brain doesn't work like mine. So I left that dinner with a different attitude about all kinds of things, and I realized that maybe it wasn't doing me any good to make the board with the red string and all of the data points and all of that kind of stuff, because clearly nobody's changing their behavior. I needed to get a better hobby. So I went to more meetings. I started sponsoring people at that point, and I was still figuring it out myself, but the cool thing about Al-Anon is it gives you the space to work on things at your own pace. I think I'm okay to say that my disease will kill me. It will just kill me in a much longer time frame. It takes a lot longer to kill an Al-Anon for untreated Al-Anonism than it does to kill an AA person for untreated alcoholism. Like, the people that I love that are sober could die much faster if they ever stopped being sober than I would if I stopped going to my meetings and doing my footwork. I will go crazy. I will lose weight and get sick and have lifelong illnesses, which I do. I have a permanent autoimmune disorder that I gave myself because of stress. It's never going to leave. It's with me forever. It's a reminder of the times that I didn't take care of myself properly and didn't pay attention to my own business. And I will live with that for the rest of my life. And I will also be attending Al-Anon meetings for the rest of my life, because if I stop going to Al-Anon meetings and if I start getting too twisted up in what you guys are doing, I'm going to wind up with that board behind me with the red string and the printouts and the cell phone bills and the pie charts, and that's just nuts. Like, that's crazy. I mean, it was good information. I was super thorough, but nobody wanted to read what I had written. Nobody wanted to pay attention to that kind of stuff, least not of all them. You know, like, I remember showing it to my spouse at the time, and he was like, yeah, I did that. And? What's your point? What do you mean, what's my point? My point is that's bad. That's bad, and you're not supposed to do it. You know, but who am I to tell somebody that's bad and they're not supposed to do it? Like, oh my goodness, the arrogance. So we had the running and hiding from the people with the motorcycles and the leather vests, and we had several vacations where we had to go and pretend that we weren't us in other towns until things cooled down, you know, and we had the parade of girlfriends and the shenanigans, and, you know, all the while I'm sitting there thinking that if I just have the right combination of dinner and holiday decorations and perfectly presented children and the right haircut and don't make anybody mad, that everything will be cool. And I'm here to tell you that none of that stuff ever worked. I don't know how many of you have ever been to an Al-Anon meeting. Did you go because you wanted to, or did you go because somebody told you to go? Did you go to more than one, or did you just go to one? Because I remember wanting to feel better enough that I was willing to do anything that the people in the meetings told me to do. And they told me to stop paying attention to him. They told me to stop following him. They told me to stop reading his text messages. They told me to stop keeping track of another person who was a grown-up, their behavior. That was really hard for me to hear, and was even harder for me to do. But once I started doing it, I had the freedom to start paying attention to my own behavior. I started to learn what I liked to do. I started to remember that I liked to go to concerts. I liked to go to concerts of bands that he didn't like to listen to. And I started doing it by myself sometimes. Because if the band that I wanted to hear was playing and I wanted to go and somebody else didn't want to go with me, I'm a grown-ass adult. I'm going to buy that ticket and I'm going to take myself to the show. And I started doing things that I liked to do. And I wasn't doing it in a mean way. I was just doing it in a necessary way. Little bit by little bit, I started to come back to myself. The day that I filed for divorce, I got 2 tattoos and my belly button pierced in the same day, because my former spouse told me that I wasn't allowed to have any more tattoos and I could never get my belly button pierced because only strippers and hookers did that. And I thought, well, you would know, and I'm going to go and do all of those things. And I did. And I felt great about it. And then I kept getting tattoos and I didn't get anything else pierced, but that's mostly just because I'm a chicken. But I got more tattoos and I developed more of a personality that had only to do with me. And a lot of that was just picking up stuff that I used to love before and I used to be good at before and I used to enjoy before I decided to spend all my time paying attention to somebody else's life more than my own. And I remember at one point thinking, before I got divorced, I remember thinking, like, what if he gets sober and doesn't like me anymore? And I was terrified, because I had spent so many years being focused on him that the idea that he wouldn't be there someday was terrifying to me. And that's not what happened. I got better and realized that I didn't like me. Like, it didn't really matter if anybody else did, because I couldn't stand being around myself. I was obnoxious. All of the things that were good about my personality and my character as a human had become distorted by my untreated Al-Anon behavior. And I had to work really hard to get back to that and to do the things that I liked to do again and not feel bad about it, because it's not selfish to take care of yourself. I started thinking about, like, I have this, it's called Just for Today. It's an Al-Anon bookmark. And I have my original one that I got back in the year 2000 at the first meeting that I went to. And it's got tape on it. And I have it on my bathroom mirror. It's got, like, toothpaste splash and stuff like that on it because I've had it for so many years. It's all warped from the shower steam. But I read it every day. I use the slogans every day. I pray every day. I talk to program people every single day because most of my friends are either in AA or Al-Anon or both. My favorite sponsor, the person that got me to the point that I'm at today, is a double winner, which I love that phrase because, like I said, when I first started talking, I love alcoholics. They're fun. They're exciting. They're always the life of the party. I'm drawn to them like a moth is drawn to the flame. But now I'm not drawn to alcoholics that are still using. I'm drawn to alcoholics that are sober and practicing a program. And I'm drawn to people that are healthy, which is something that I wasn't always a part of. I am healthy, so I am drawn to people that are healthy. I want to become more healthy, so I want to be around people that are wanting to become more healthy. Like I heard at an open AA meeting, like, I want to hang out with the winners. I don't want to hang out with the losers. I love the losers too, because I am one of those. You know, I can slip back into my old behavior very easily, usually after a phone call with my children's father, because I'm good for about 20 minutes talking to that guy, and then I all of a sudden just spiral down and get into old behavior real quick and real easy, which is interesting. At this many years into program, I still have to focus on that stuff and those steps every single day. Otherwise, I will go back to being the crazy person real easily. I have three children, and I have one child that identifies as an alcoholic, and I have two children that don't identify as anything. I could see where maybe they would benefit from an Al-Anon meeting because they're a lot like their mom. They have that disease of addiction to people, just like I do. But that's okay because they were raised in a program household. They were raised with the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, and that is something that I'm grateful for, that I had that framework to be a parent with. Because even though my mom and dad were fantastic parents, we didn't have that structure. And I'm really grateful that I got to have Al-Anon as my co-parent. Because I didn't have my former spouse as a co-parent, but I had my sponsor, I had my Al-Anon friends, I had people in meetings, I had their experience, strength, and hope that led me to be a better mom and have helped me be a better person. I'm a better employee because of 12-step programs. I'm a better friend because of 12-step programs. And I don't pay attention to somebody else's business more than my own anymore. Talk about having a lot of free time. Like, I used to crack jokes about my ex-husband having more hours in his day because of the substance that he chose to use. But I have more free time now that I'm not all the way up someone else's backside. Like, I have so many more hours in my day to do things that I like to do now that I'm not paying attention to what you're doing or what you're doing or what you're not doing. It's amazing how much free time I gained when I started minding my own business. I encourage everybody to give it a shot. If you haven't gone to an Al-Anon meeting, I would say go to 6 before you make up your mind, and then maybe go to 6 more. And then maybe go to 6 in a different area. Now I go to Al-Anon meetings when I'm on vacation. I go to Al-Anon meetings when I'm away places for work. I've gone to Al-Anon meetings in other states. I've gone to AA meetings, too. I like open AA meetings because I feel like it's always good for me to remember what things used to be like in my life and in the people that I love so that I don't go back to that dark spot. I heard somebody say in an AA meeting once that gifts come wrapped in a problem box. And that's one of my favorite phrases that I picked up at a meeting because every single good thing that's happened in my life started off from something bad, like without question. I would not be sane and happy and healthy and any kind of functional if I hadn't gone to Al-Anon. And I wouldn't have gone to Al-Anon unless I had been absolutely on my face, on the floor, in desperation to change the way my life was going because I was in so much pain. I wouldn't have the life that I have if it wasn't for Al-Anon. So I'm super grateful for all that bad stuff. I'm grateful that I had to go and hide in another state from some really gnarly people. I'm grateful that the Secret Service showed up at my house one day with a warrant to search my home because of some things that my children's father was involved in. And then what did I do, being the good Al-Anon person that I am? I asked him if they wanted coffee. or cookies. You know, can I get you anything? Just I answered the door in my nightgown. I still remember the officer's name. His name was Benjamin Ventura, and that always reminded me of Ace Ventura, and I think that's why I made the correlation, because my brain works that way. But I remember him coming to the door and having a search warrant, and I remember thinking, like, wow, this is a super out-of-body experience. Like, there's a member of an official government agency at my door with a search warrant? Whose life is this? Like, what the heck? You know? And I forgot to tell you guys about the time that I went so super crazy that I got into a car accident. And I say accident loosely because I don't think anything's an accident. I think everything happens on purpose, whether we recognize it at the time or not. But when my children's father was busy doing his 13th step work, there was a time where the individual involved in that process with him called me on the phone and was telling me all kinds of really gross, disgusting things. And I got upset and I got in my car because at the time I still smoked cigarettes. So I was going to go for a drive and smoke a cigarette and calm down. My mom came over to watch my kids, and I was just going to go clear my head. So I'm driving, and I'm listening to music, and I'm smoking a cigarette, and he wound up on the road in front of me because we lived in a small town, and he had come up to visit the children, and we had an argument, and he left, and I left, and we went in opposite directions initially, but then we wound up on the road one in front of the other. And like I said, I call it an accident lightly because what happened that day was I drove straight into the back of his car. He drove a bright yellow Lexus. It was a Lexus IS300. It was the very first model that ever came out, and he bought it brand new off the showroom floor. And when I tell you that I hated that car, I hated that car because that car was the symbol of everything that was wrong in my life. I had my little mom car, and I'm driving my little Jeep Grand Cherokee mom car, and I just drove straight into the back of him. Didn't stop, nothing. And I used to make a lot of fun of people who said that they had lost control of themselves and something bad had happened as a result of that. I thought it was absolute nonsense until it happened to me. And I can tell you that I was absolutely not in control of myself at that time. I was going to Al-Anon meetings, but I was not well because I was sitting in a meeting, but I wasn't doing any work. I was just listening to you guys share, and I was reading the things that were on the pamphlets, and I was, you know, saying the prayer at the end of it and clapping for people when they shared, but I really wasn't doing any work, so I wasn't well. And we got into this car accident where I drove into the back of his vehicle, and his car did a 180, and then we wound up hitting each other again. The airbags went off in his car. Nothing happened to my Jeep. Jeeps are clearly the superior vehicle. My brother saw this scene. He was on his way home from work, and he saw this scene, and he stopped, and he got out of the vehicle. And I was still in my car, and my children's father was outside of his car. I don't remember this part. This is what was told to me later. It was like one of those blackout situations where you don't really know what you're doing, even though I was sober. That's why I don't judge anybody, because I was sober, you guys. There was not a single substance in my body, and I was doing some absolutely insane stuff. That was crazy. That's a crazy person thing to do. And apparently, on the list of crazy things I did that day, when my brother was stopping to realize, oh my gosh, that's my sister's car. Oh my gosh, that's my brother-in-law's car. Wait, that's police cars. What's happening? Apparently, I was sitting in my car revving the engine because my children's father was standing in front of my vehicle and I just had it in neutral and I guess I was just revving the engine because I guess I was trying to prove a point. I'm not really sure because I don't remember doing that. But I do remember being arrested, which is embarrassing to say, but it was a necessary part of my process. And I remember that the officer that arrested me was the same officer that arrested my ex-husband a handful of months prior, which is why he had gone to rehab, was to avoid going to jail. And the officer asked him, "What happened to you? I remember you. What happened to you?" And I just started crying, and I said, "He did." And I just, something in me broke that day. And I knew I needed to make a change. Because remember, I'm the rule follower. I'm the good girl. I'm the one that doesn't get in trouble. And there I was on a very busy street in the town that I had grown up in handcuffs, where God and everybody could see me out there, and you know, clearly, because my brother saw. And I was like, all right, it's time to do something different, folks. I might have a problem. And I remember realizing that things had gotten so far out of hand at that point. And I was in jail, in the holding cell, excuse me, and there was three women in there with me. And one of them, I'm pretty sure, was a working girl, based on her uniform. And another one was a gang member, and I could tell that based on the way she looked. And then there was another older lady, and they all thought that I was a narc. Because I looked the way I looked, and I was dressed the way I was dressed, and I didn't look like any of them, and they were like, mm-mm, we're not talking to her, because she's going to rat on us. Like, that one's trouble. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm not. I'm not a narc. I'm here because I did something bad. And they're like, well, what did you do? And so then I told them what I did, and the older of the ladies came over and gave me a big hug, and she's all, atta girl, atta kill them. And I was like, well, I mean, if I had been paying attention to the process, I guess I might have too, but I wasn't really, you know, within myself at that moment. And they, you know, it is true, like it does happen, like you see on TV, they do give you a phone call. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go make my phone call. Who am I going to call? I called my spouse at the time. I called his drug dealer because I figured he would have the money to bail me out. and also his phone number was one of the only ones I could remember by heart in a moment of trauma, because remember how good I was at doing research and tracking him down and finding out where he was. So of course I had the drug dealer's phone number. Duh. Had to cross-reference that with all the other phone numbers, oops, sorry, and figure out where things were happening. So I called him, and he laughed, and he thought it was funny, and he's like, you know what? He's like, he goes, I would bail you out, but my cash is kind of tied up. He's like, but I am going to get you a trophy, because that was really funny what you did. And I'm like, no, I don't want a trophy. I just want to go home. So I spent the night in jail that night, and my parents bailed me out, and I went to court. They got me a lawyer. And all of these things are strange sentences for me to be saying to you based on who I was every day before that day. But here I am with a criminal attorney, and I'm in court, and I'm having to answer for my behavior. And I was given a year of anger management classes and 1,800 hours of community service, which was the most that I think anybody had ever been given in my little valley at that time. And I was doing community service for a really long time. I did it at the bingo hall, and I did it on the road crew, and I did it at the public works yard, and I got really familiar with all kinds of activities that I had never taken part in before. But I did all my community service, and I did my anger management classes, and I actually learned some valuable things from that time. And I was grateful, and I'm still grateful, because things could have been a lot worse. I could have had to go to jail, and I could have lost custody of my kids, and I could have killed him, and that would have been terrible, because just because I felt some type of way about his behavior didn't mean I had the right to treat him that way, and I didn't have the right to treat myself that way, and Al-Anon meetings helped me learn that about myself. I don't get that angry anymore. I don't get that crazy anymore because I know better now, and I know where to put those emotions and feelings when I get upset. It's not to say that life hasn't had its challenges since I did my steps the first time, the second time, the seventh time, because I've done them more than once. This isn't something that you can just do one time and then you're good. You have to continue to take your inventory. You have to continue to do your steps and stay in contact with your God. You have to keep going to meetings. You have to keep minding your own business. That one's still challenging sometimes. Being a parent and having some kids that like to do some things that look like the things that I did when I was unwell and that look like the things that their dad did when he was unwell could be kind of challenging. Over the years, since my childhood, my father has become a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can say that with his permission because he's proud of his sobriety. And he knows that I'm speaking here today, and I have a fantastic relationship with my dad. My dad is, in my opinion, he is like the perfect example of what it looks like when you do AA the right way. He makes a living amends to me and to my kids every single day. And I couldn't be more proud of the man that he is and the things that he's gone through. I do not have a relationship with my children's father more than I need to, and that's good for both of us. Because the way he works his program is different than the way other people work their program. And that's all I'll say about that, because it's not my business, right? I had some expectations about the way things were going to look for he and I. And I used to think that there would be a time where we would be able to do like a split pitch with like a sober person and the Al-Anon person, and that's just not going to be our story. And that makes me sad. I can say that now. I can look at you guys and say that I'm sad that things didn't work out the way I thought they were going to work out in my marriage and with my children's father. But I'm super grateful that he was in my life, because like I said earlier, if he hadn't been who he was, I wouldn't be who I am. And I like who I am. I like being a member of 12-step programs, and I like being able to hang out with people like you who are trying to do something good for themselves and be better despite where they grew up or what they married or what they did or what they didn't do, because I think that's who the real successful people in the world are. Doesn't matter what your job is, it doesn't matter where you live or what you wear or how much money you have. We've all got problems and we've all got nonsense and backstories and embarrassing things that we did. I want to know what you're doing with it now. I want to know where you're going in your future. And if you're here today and you're listening to me talk and you've listened to any of these other people talk, I think you're doing the right thing. I think that you're doing something really good, because for every person that's in an AA meeting, there are people that should be in an Al-Anon meeting, at least two or three, because it is a family disease. There's so many people that are impacted by our behavior. Even as an Al-Anon person, there's so many people that have been impacted by my behavior, good and bad. And I just feel like every single one of these chairs should be full, and there should be no room to stand in a meeting always, because we all need one, in my opinion. And it makes me so excited when I see a newcomer, and it makes me really happy when I hear somebody say, oh yeah, so-and-so's going to AA now. And I'm like, yes, that's awesome. Are you going to go to Al-Anon now? Are you going to come to a meeting with me? You want to come? Because I just feel like we all need this structure, and we all benefit when we're working these steps and doing this program. Some of my best friends in my life I found in an Al-Anon meeting. And I'm so lucky and so fortunate that that happened. I'm super grateful that I don't have to pay attention to someone else's behavior to the point that I get into a car accident and wreck two perfectly good cars. Like, that was lame. I mean, really, it's a fun story now, but like, it wasn't fun at the time. You know, it's fun to crack jokes about the time that the Secret Service showed up at my house with a search warrant. And, you know, like, I can tell that story now and laugh about it, but it wasn't fun at the time. It was scary. It's funny now to talk about going into hiding for 6 months with my kids. Y'all, I took my kids out of school for 6 months. And then I stayed married to that guy for like another 10 years. What the heck? You know, like, what was I thinking? One of the last things I'm going to share with you about the definition of insanity is, after I got divorced and I moved into the first house that I lived in on my own, right? Because I was a rule follower, so I stayed at home at my mom and dad's house until I got married. Even though my former spouse and I owned a house, I wouldn't move in with him because we weren't married yet, because that's how obnoxious I was about following the rules and being a good girl. Gross. But that's what I did. So I went from my mom and dad's house to the house that I lived in as a married person, and then after I got divorced, I lived on my own. And it was time for me to decide what I liked and what I wanted, and I didn't know any of those things. So my ex-husband and I sold the house. I call it my big married lady house, because it was a huge house. Like, it was ridiculously huge. And it was like the perfect house, right? And we sold that perfect house. And on the last day, before I locked the door for the last time and handed the keys over to the real estate agent, I realized that I didn't take down the ceiling fan that I wanted. This fan in my bedroom that I really liked, and it was like really expensive at the time, and it was a really cool fan, and I loved it. And I like ceiling fans. I like the noise. I like the breeze. I just had this fan going like 24 hours a day for like 10 years. So I had a friend of mine take the fan down, and when I moved into the house that I live in now, which I moved into in 2013, so I've been there a little over 10 years, and I had that ceiling fan put up in the bedroom that I lived in that house. The fan was hooked up, connected, all that good stuff. But I needed to find the remote control, because it was like a fancy fan. You couldn't just work it from the switch. It had a remote. And I couldn't find the remote. I don't know what box that was in. I don't know, because I moved out of my married lady house in a big hurry, and I had like a packing party, and all these people came from the meeting, and they helped me pack up my house, and like I put it in storage, and my kids and I had to go and live with my parents for a while until I was able to get this house that I live in now. And the day that we moved out of that house, 22 men and women from AA in the town that I live in showed up to help me move out. And that's tremendous. There was AA people and there was Al-Anon people, and it was like this box brigade, and everybody loaded all of our stuff up, and they did that because they're kind humans. And I was very grateful. And one of those gentlemen hung that fan up for me, and it hung up and it stayed in my bedroom for 10 years. A little bit longer than that. Just recently, I moved out of that bedroom in my house and into the main bedroom in the house. Because when I moved in, I had all three of my kids living at home. They were all young, and my two sons shared that main primary bedroom because it had its own bathroom, and that was a perfect setup for two boys. And, you know, I had a bedroom, and then my daughter had a bedroom. So now that the kids are all grown and doing their own thing, and I could move into the main bedroom in the house that I own and pay all the bills in, I thought, well, maybe I should do that. And so I moved into that bedroom, and I'm looking at that fan, and I'm realizing that in all the time that I have lived in that house, that fan has never turned on. It never did the fan things, and it never did the light things, because it wasn't hooked up properly. And you guys, I kept that fan up in my ceiling for 11 years just because it was my fan. And so I put it up, and it's my fan, and it goes in my bedroom, and so there it is. And it never did fan things, and it never did light things. But I kept it there. That's some serious insanity. Why did I never think to take that fan down and put up a different light fixture? I don't know. Because that was my fan. That's such a weird sentence to say. Like, I just realized that about a week ago, because we took the fan down and put up a light fixture that does light things. It turns on. It lights the room. You can read. It's fantastic. 11 years I lived in that room with a light fixture that didn't do any of its jobs. I'm like, that is the craziest thing. I'm kind of embarrassed to share that with you guys, except for I know that if there's ever a place where I wouldn't be judged for having a ceiling fan in my room that didn't fan or light, it's a room like this. Because maybe you guys have done something crazy like that too, because, you know, that was my fan, and that's what you do. You put the ceiling fan up in the room. You hold on to the relationship. You hold on to the attitude. You keep the horrible hope. You keep doing the same thing, thinking that you're going to get a different result. Until you learn better and you stop doing that and you start doing better for yourself. And then that trickle-down effect happens, and then you notice one day that your kids are doing better, and your parents are doing better, and you're doing better. And I owe that all to Al-Anon and to AA, because gifts come wrapped in a problem box, and that's a phrase that I share with everybody. I encourage people to go to open AA meetings, and I encourage people to go to Al-Anon meetings, because you never know what you're going to hear that might help you and might make you feel better. But I do know that you'll never feel better if you don't come to a meeting. I'm not telling anybody what to do. I'm just saying what worked for me, and what worked for me is doing the 12 steps, taking direction from people who had more experience, strength, or hope than I did, and for remembering not to be crazy. And if I do that, everything works out all right. So thanks for letting me share.